It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, Farm to Table Talk is often talking to people that live in rural areas. But some people actually are studying and getting involved with issues and policy and what's really happening in rural areas. None more engaged than my guest today, and it's Gail Wadsworth, who is the executive director until the end of this podcast, Gail. Let's make this pretty dramatic here, of the California Institute of Rural Studies. And Gail, how did we happen to schedule a podcast conversation with you on the day that you retired? This is it, right?
This is it. Well, you know, you responded to my email about my retirement, so I think that's what kind of triggered this.
Well, yeah, I did. I get this email, and I get emails, as you might imagine now, from agriculture, food organizations, food justice even, all over the world. And I'm getting this one from the Institute of Rural Studies. And the first thing, I had to scratch my head and think, well, so what do you do? I know what institutes often do, but what do you do if you're studying rural or rural studies? And then I read some more, and it's the fact that you've been the executive director for 10 years, and now you're stepping down as the executive director. And I thought, well, who better to talk to me about what you do when you're involved with rural studies, and what are some of the issues and concerns that you focus on? And I think it'd be of interest to people that care about listening to Farm to Table Talk. So what is it? What do you do?
What is it we do? We do primarily research in rural communities in California. And our research is focused on amplifying the voice of rural Californians who frequently are left out of conversations, which I'm really happy that you do this kind of conversation. And, you know, those populations are generally low-income, frequently farm workers, also farmers themselves who are, you know, struggling to get by. So we really try to focus on that sort of social justice issues around rural California. We've done a lot of research on food security of farm workers. We've done a lot of work with farmers. We just finished a study on climate change and how farmers are responding to climate change. What else? Farm worker housing, farm worker health, primarily farm worker issues, I think.
Well, I mean, the country's filled with people living out there right now, and they're not all farm workers.
Right.
So some of these rural areas are just people that are commuting into work anymore, that are having to live further and further away from the Bay Area and from, you know, wherever, Los Angeles, and commute in. And I'm curious, does that create any kind of special circumstances of people out living amongst, you know, farm workers or other people that are engaged in agriculture, and people being forced out of the cities because of the high cost of housing?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, some of the most recent issues we've been dealing with down in the eastern Coachella Valley are kind of the opposite of that. Although we see this inland move from the coasts, we see a huge inland push from urban areas, coastal areas, into rural California. And in my own county, Contra Costa County, this has caused, you know, severe traffic issues. The cost of housing is much more reasonable, you know, outside. But yeah, it's caused challenges for people in general within the populated areas. But when we're talking about rural areas and people moving into them, frequently what we find is this displacement of the population that's currently there and the transformation of really valuable agricultural land into land that is now used for housing. And so there are all kinds of conflicts that arise from this transformation of land, from this kind of dismissal of the current population. And then also, I think, you know, frequently conflicts between the existing population and the new population that's coming in. So we have right to farm laws in the state, which are really valuable for people who are engaged in agriculture, who are abutting, you know, like suburban housing and that sort of thing.
What does that mean, right to farm?
It means basically that farmers, that people, when they're buying their houses next to agricultural land, need to understand that there are going to be, maybe there's going to be dust, or there will be odors that they're not used to, or noisy machinery, that sort of thing, and that these farmers have a right to proceed in that way, and that if you're buying this property, you need to be aware of that.
So in the 10 years that you've been involved with projects like this, are things getting better? I mean, you look at an entire decade, and you know, you've, and we'll talk some more about some of the activities that you focused on. But in a general way, if you go back these last 10 years, is it better or worse than it was?
It's better in some ways and worse in some ways. So I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Well, you've answered it pretty well so far, but you're going to have to give me an example of both.
How it's better and how it's worse. Farm workers are much more taken care of on farms. They're more aware of their rights. We have really amazing heat illness laws in the state of California, and employees who are out working in the fields under hot conditions know their rights. They're well taken care of, and farmers are following those regulations. So in that respect, it's much better. In the respect of farmland conservation, I think that there's always pressure from developers, and I think that that's going to continue. There's always going to be pressure to move out into what people view as this open space. And I think that we have a real disconnect in California and urban. I live in a suburban area, so urban and suburban livers really look at farmland is this open space, and they're not really considering it as a working landscape. And so it's also gotten better in that way, that people are starting to understand that agricultural land is working landscape. And it's definitely gotten better from the perspective of people understanding the importance of buying locally, right? So farmers are really, the profile of farmers in California has really been uplifted by the buy local movement, and urban dwellers are really understanding the importance of buying locally. So I think, you know, better and worse. How is it worse?
Well, let's go back to someplace that you said was better, and that is the conditions for the workers themselves. Mm-hmm. It has improved over the period of time. Have you had something to do with that? Have you, is it rules or regulations that you've been engaged with in the organization that's affected that, or, you know, good intentions by other organizations recognizing it's, you know, they should encourage people to do the right thing? I mean, what's the cause of that progress?
I think that it is. We worked with the Western Center for Agricultural Health and Safety on a five-year project called the California Heat Illness Prevention Study. And in that study, we were responsible for conversations with farm workers themselves. And the Western Center at UC Davis was responsible for actually measuring the impacts of exertion and heat on workers while they were working in the fields. And I believe that the results of those studies bolstered the stringent regulations for heat illness in California.
What about housing, where people are living in rural areas, and that probably gets into things like water quality and availability of schools for kids and things like that.
Yeah, housing for low-income workers in California is abysmal, as you know. Housing in California,
right,
is a struggle for most people. We did a housing assessment for farm workers in the Salinas Pajaro Valleys, and our estimate for the need for building housing simply to reduce the crowdedness of housing of farm workers, our recommendation was that they needed to build 47,000 units of housing simply to reduce current crowdedness of housing. That's another entire city. Mm-hmm. They're taking action. I have to say that we also created an action plan for all the municipalities and organizations that participated in the study. And they're taking action. They're making a difference. And that led to Assemblymember Rivas introducing AB 1783, which was just passed and signed by Governor Newsom to streamline the building of farmworker housing. But it's pretty abysmal in the eastern Coachella Valley. Farmworkers live in substandard conditions. Mobile home parks, we started a study in the eastern Coachella Valley 8 years ago, and the first thing we did was to map all of the sort of hidden mobile home parks. And these are permitted by law. You can build up to 12 units of housing on agricultural land for workers. And so there are these little pockets of 12 mobile home parks scattered throughout the Coachella Valley. We counted 100, mapped 124 of these mobile home parks in a fairly small region of California, in an area where it's difficult to get electricity. It's not suitable for septic tanks, and the private wells are all contaminated with arsenic. So,
housing is naturally occurring.
It's naturally occurring, but housing is a real issue.
Is this uniquely California? I know you work with all over the country. I mean, you have organizations. I've seen that you've been involved with other projects around the United States, and then I see some things in other around the world that I hear reports too that so to what extent is this just kind of a problem that's universal, or is it especially California?
I think it's extreme in California.
Yeah,
because there's such a pressure on land, and land is so expensive. People don't want to build low-income housing. Developers don't want to do that, right? Because it's not as profitable for them. If they're investing all this money into purchasing land and you know, building homes, they're going to want to build things that are going to make them money.
So you're able to identify these as issues, and then I suppose you get involved in promoting either regulations or legislation or funding to be able to relieve this stress somehow.
Right. In our one of our seminal studies, the California Agricultural Workers Health Study, in 2000, that was funded by the California Endowment, we did a survey of almost 1,000 agricultural workers in the state in 9 different communities, and determined the need for health care. And the California Endowment then, over the subsequent decade, invested tens of millions of dollars in improving health care for farm workers. And so we find is that data really can spur investment, can change legislation, and while we don't lobby ourselves, we provide the tools for creating advocacy in communities. So in the Eastern Coachella Valley, we're working on tools for residents to advocate for themselves. And I think it's really important also to keep in mind that our definition of data isn't just numbers and graphs. We also find that gathering and conveying stories, personal stories, like you do on your podcast, mm-hmm. is really important for swaying opinion and getting people to respond. So I can tell you, you know, I can show you data that shows that agricultural workers in real dollars are making lower wages than they were in the 1970s. But if I tell you a story about a worker who works on the coast and makes $65 a day picking strawberries, and then goes home and has to pay her daycare worker $50, that's more impactful, I think, to understand that she's worked all day for $15 in her pocket. I can show you the graph and tell you the story, and I find that those two types of data are much more useful together, the qualitative and the quantitative.
You know, I've seen some of these studies of issues around the world, and one of the things that struck me is that all over the world there are problems like this. I mean, obviously, you hit on something. California, land's expensive, housing expensive, and there's special. It's more intense here than in some areas. But as far as the workers' conditions, you know, I've seen some like in southern Italy that are bringing workers in from northern Africa, and it just looks kind of outrageous of issues that they're having to deal with, and it's a lot for a consumer to get wrap their arms around, or a taxpayer. I mean, you know, everybody's got their own worries, and trying to think about how do I know that we're dealing with companies that care about the workers or care about the system. Maybe that's the reason that there's so much attention right now on farm stories and companies that are putting on the back of their packages of different things and saying, you know, our farms are doing this and our farmers are treating their workers this way and we want to be totally transparent. I mean, do you get involved in trying to promote that transparency and say, be a good story and stand up and tell it?
I think what you're saying is really, really true and really important. And it is difficult for consumers. There are so many labels and so many certifications out there. It's hard to know what's really true. I mean, I remember a few years ago going to Whole Foods and looking at the coffee, and there was fair trade, bird friendly, shade grown, organic. And I was like, well, how do I know? How do I even, you know, I know, and I know what all these certifications mean. I think probably, you know, I don't know. I think it's really hard for consumers to know if workers are being well cared for, if workers are being paid well. And that's why I think it's important to work on so many different levels, to provide data for legislators, to provide tools for workers themselves, to advocate for themselves, and to provide information for consumers. The whole system cannot be consumer driven. It has to be bottom up, top down, and then from the middle as well.
How much do you work with farmers that might be, you know, employing people that are, well, just that, just the farmers, I mean, they've got their own rural issues. They're living in many cases, they're living in the rural areas themselves, and they're trying to make a living. Do you touch them in any way?
Absolutely. And I think that CRS as an organization understands that it's difficult for farmers. Farmers are working on such low margins. Mm-hmm. The idea, and I understand when they push back and say we can't pay higher wages or we can't pay overtime because their margins are so low. And so it's really important for us to work with farmers because we don't think that there's a huge gap between most growers and their employees. You know, I think they're all working, you know, on the margins, just on the edge. So we do a lot of work with farmers. Farmers are essential in our work. They give us access to their workers. They give us information. We work with them also to provide tools for them to help them improve their bottom line. So we try to work across that entire spectrum because we understand when new regulations are imposed on farmers that they're going to struggle to adapt to those. And it's been really encouraging to me to see that despite, you know, a lot of pushback from growers about providing shade, providing water, giving breaks to workers, you know, under hot conditions, that they're all doing that. That every one of them that I've spoken to follows those regulations. And so I think that's, you know, something important for people to keep in mind is that while at the outset these regulations may seem onerous to growers, they're just amazingly adaptable people, and they adapt. They adapt to almost everything. But we realize it's a challenge.
Well, you'll hear farmers say that it's much tougher for them in California because of these regulations. And I get the impression that they understand the need to make these improvements. I think there's just as an expression of frustration that some states, and certainly other countries, aren't up to the same standards, and yet they can sell a product and compete with them.
Right.
And they're cutting corners in some of those areas, and these farmers, you know, are going to facing a higher cost of regulations and rules and just cost of doing business, and not necessarily getting the recognition,
benefit.
Not getting
right.
the benefit from it.
Right, and I understand that completely, and that's one reason why we've been working on the federal level with other organizations like in Florida and New York, to get a federal adoption of these heat illness regulation policies, to make it a federal law, so that there's at least that one aspect is a bit more uniform across the country. And we've also encouraged growers to work across borders, because frequently they're being squeezed by buyers. So, you know, we've talked to growers in California who grow tomatoes, who are competing with growers in Mexico who grow tomatoes, who are paying, you know, lower wages. And we've said to them, you know, it's important for you to form an alliance across borders to not fall prey to, you know, these buyers' tactics of saying, well, I can get my tomatoes for this much in Mexico, so, you know, you'd need to sell them to me for, you know, for a lower price here in California. To form alliances among growers, I think, would be really beneficial, because it is challenging. We know that farming is not an easy, you know, it's not an easy profession. Before I started working at California Institute for Rural Studies, I did a lot of independent work with growers themselves, and I just don't see how they can make it. It's just incredibly challenging, and yet we all need to eat. And so, I mean, I don't have a solution to this, you know, to this issue. I think that I would like it if every state adopted the same sorts of regulations that we have in California. If every farm worker was paid, you know, minimum wage, if every farm worker was paid overtime nationally, that would be fantastic, because I do understand that these regulations in California put growers at a disadvantage.
Well, and then some of the commodities that were here, that were employing people here, paying minimum wage or higher for their farm workers, have lost out to what was then called NAFTA, and I'm not quite sure what our acronym is right now, but and instead they moved to, at the time, they moved to northern Mexico, where they're paying the workers $2 an hour, where they were paying the workers $10 an hour in Stockton, and it's on its way up to $15 an hour here. And so the business moves, and you know, you can sense that frustration, because certainly farmers would like to make enough money to be paying more, and yet no one quite wants to go so far as to point out, well, if you're buying a product that's from here, probably people are getting paid better and treated better, and there's more safety issues than if you're importing them from some other countries. And you told me that you've lived in other countries. You lived in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suspect that some of the standards of production, some of the products there are different than maybe some of the other areas in South Asia. So it gets tricky that how much communication should be going on to the consumer to tell the story of what the conditions are of the workers and safety and environment and so forth, and where the food's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for people to understand, people who are living in California, to understand that we are paying a higher price, but the benefit to workers and to growers themselves and to our environment and to all of these things that we value within our state, the price is worth it. To me, the price is worth it. But I also think that, you know, one thing I learned in a recent panel I did at EcoFarm last January is that growers in Mexico are paying other things. They're paying low wages, but they also have to pay for national health care. They have to pay for housing and transportation for their workers. And this is becoming more of a reality for employers in California as well, as workers have stopped coming across the border, and employers are hiring more H-2A or temporary workers, that these growers are now going to have to pay that additionally, you know, housing, transportation, and food for these workers that they're importing. But what I learned in this conversation at EcoFarm last year was that growers in Mexico, while they're paying lower hourly wages, are paying a lot of other things. They're paying tariffs when they bring their products in. They're paying, you know, all of these other things for workers as well that currently employers in California don't necessarily have to pay for.
You know, it's such a challenge because on one hand, the obvious answer is that food should cost more. But then that affects people. They're buying food. Right. They're having a hard time making ends meet right now. But as you point out, that that people aren't getting rich farming, they're not getting rich labor, and we've got a really abundance of delicious food, and we're paying maybe 10 or 12% of our average disposable income. And again, it's easy to say, maybe it ought to just be a little higher, but then it hurts people too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing that I would encourage people in California to do, because we can do this, and that would be to buy direct from growers, right? Cut out that middleman. Go to farmers markets. We have them year-round here. Talk to the farmers. Ask them about their workers. Frequently, their workers are the ones who work in the fields and are also selling at their farm stands at farmers markets. And all the money that you're giving then to the farmer is going directly into his or her pocket. And that then gives them much more flexibility to pay their workers well, you know, to manage their crops well. And it also gives them this connection with their buyers. I can't even express, I think, the importance to me of this direct connection to growers that we have in California. We were talking earlier, my relatives live in Colorado, and if they had to shop at farmers markets year-round, they'd be eating potatoes and beef and nothing else, you know? So I think that we really take this for granted, that we have this amazing abundance of produce that's being grown here, and we have that ability to meet the people who are growing it, to talk to them about it, and to give them our money.
But you know, even in Colorado or some of these other states, there's a couple of things happening. I mean, one is there's more incentives for supporting these local businesses and food incubators, mm-hmm. and people are preparing salsas and other kind of preserved products that they're marketing at the farmer's market because they don't have a year-round season production. And people are able to come in and use different sorts of things if they're able to have what was, I keep forgetting, but what was food stamps now, but you can actually use them at the farmer's market and get discounts too.
Right.
So in all of those areas too, you know, there's progress being made.
Right.
I like what you said about, like, when you cut out the middleman, local areas, certainly there's just more opportunities when people can go direct. One of the things for some of our fresh products that we grow. Otherwise, they also have to chill them and add some sort of gas to the trucks and so forth to be able to truck them all the way across the country and consume them 3 weeks later. And where they're able to just have it go, you know, pick yesterday and be at a market or community-supported agriculture or something like that. That's good for part of the system.
Right. I think it's I think it's something that we take for granted here. And you're right, it's happening all across the country. And you know, in California, it's great that the Homemade Food Act was passed, so people can can use these products and sell them, and that farmers can do that as well without necessarily needing a huge commercial kitchen if they're a small operation. So,
you know, when you've been involved in issues like this for the last 10 years. And now you're not. What are you going to miss?
You know, I didn't think I was going to miss anything, but on my last trip down to Coachella, where I've been, you know, directly involved, our projects are usually fairly fast. We do a survey, we analyze the results, and we produce reports, and usually that's like takes a year. I've been in Coachella for 8 years, and when I was getting ready to say goodbye to people down there and realizing that I was calling this my farewell tour, I was really going to miss those connections with people. Connections with growers, I'll maintain those connections that I've had with growers, which I had before I started at CIRS. But connections with people who are really striving to make their lives better, who are really advocating for themselves, in that sense of community. I think that's what I'll miss the most.
In that period of time, were you able to see some of the folks that you were in contact early on be able to raise kids in the rural area, send them off to, Fresno State or UC Davis or someplace and either come back or have you, if it's not of the full length of somebody who would be in school, but have you seen some of them that have come back to be able to somehow engage and help the communities that you were helping?
Yeah, what I've seen is youth who may come to meetings and not be interested, go away to college and come back and become advocates within their communities. That to me is really inspiring. The fact that they would maybe be the first in their family to go to university and to want to come back to these communities that are so impacted and improve those communities. And I've seen, people that I've started working with who are basically traveling along their line and decide, I really want to make change. So I'm going to run for public office. So I've seen a lot of people that started out with no interest in this sort of political world, run for office and become city council people or water board members. And so I think that's incredibly inspiring to see this influx of young people coming back into rural communities and saying, I want to change this. I want to make it better for myself and for my kids. Really inspiring. So
it's inspiring to see that. And as you say that, I was just thinking that lately I've been seeing people that are everything from running to president to congressman and others. And there have been quite a few that have said that their parents came over that were field workers and that they've grown up and they sacrificed for them. And I know many farmers and farm organizations that are providing scholarships for their farm workers' kids.
Yeah,
that are helping that take place. And it is great to see them come back and help their community. And that's exciting. So.
Yeah, we have frequently hired researchers on our projects who are children of farm workers, and we've hired people who are no longer farm workers who are advocates within their communities to help us with our work. Without those connections to the community, we could never get our work done, and that's both with relationship to farm workers and farmers as well. Without farmers and farm workers, we wouldn't exist.
So if you were going to look ahead, that's this next 10 years, because you've got the 10 years that you've been in this position, coming to an end today, again, very dramatically. But if you look into the next 10 years, what's your hope? I mean, how do you hope that this evolves and the circumstances in rural areas are different in the future maybe than they've been in the past?
That's a challenging question, but I would say that my hope would be for increasing leadership among young people, right? I'm old. The researchers that I've worked with, the founder of CIRS and other researchers who are experts in their field, we're all aging out, and we need to see the next kind of vanguard of youth. And we see them in universities. I'm so inspired by the University of California at Merced, the way that it's really focusing on local students and students of color. I think that my hope is to see this upsurge of youth, and specifically youth of color in rural regions, taking their place in making policy, in becoming leaders, and in making the change that they want to see for their communities.
That's an exciting vision. And if people want to find out more about the Institute of Rural Studies, where do they find that information?
Our website.
Okay, and which is?
CIRSINC.org.
Are there opportunities for people to be involved or volunteers to get engaged with the organization?
Absolutely. We're always looking for people who are interested in this work. We have a very small staff. Now that I'm leaving, only two people. We do a lot of work with individual community members. We have volunteers. Every March at UC Merced, we have an event called the Rural Justice Summit, which is phenomenal. We expanded it to 2 days last year. One day is a day of intense conversation with researchers and policymakers and advocates and students and youth. And the second day is a community celebration at the Merced Multicultural Arts Center, where local artists perform. We're always looking for people to participate in that amazing and inspiring event.
So what's next for you now that this is going? I mean, we go a month or so down the road, and I check in with you and say, "Okay, Gail, how's life different now? Are you beginning, or will you yet be getting into some other new hobbies or new activities, or have you thought about it yet?"
Well, Monday I'm leaving for Iceland for a
for a holiday. That's different.
Today's Thursday or Friday? Today's Thursday. Monday I'm leaving for Iceland for 10 days. I expect I'll be able to spend a lot more time with my grown children and my husband. And I think that I'll probably stay involved. It's hard once you're inserted into this world, as you well know.
Yeah.
It's hard to extract oneself. We have a house in New Mexico, so I expect I'll get more involved in this sort of work in New Mexico as well. But I haven't really thought about, I'm at the end of my career. I'll support these movements going forward. I'll support groups like the Food Chain Workers Alliance, continue with CIRS and all of the work that people are doing that is so positive for the world. But I don't have any specific plans, and it's actually kind of liberating to have that.
Well, I have a feeling that the universe is going to find you, so enjoy it while you can in Iceland and New Mexico, but people know people that care and get involved, and I think that for all those, we owe you some gratitude for committing your time and effort to a nonprofit organization like this. It's doing good, and you certainly have had impact. So, Gail Wadsworth, enjoy this transition, and thanks for all you've done at the California Institute of Rural Studies.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.